for making all of this possible, and as I said last week, for encouraging me. Encouraging is a gentler word than it was, but for encouraging me to take this on. Last week, I explained at the outset that I was nervous because this is not a type of a topic that I address often, and so I was nervous about how it would work out. Now I did it last week, so how nervous could I be? Except that Ellie said such nice things, to me about how it went last time, and now they have a whole other type of nervous, which is, well, can you match that, or is that like lightning in a bottle? Yeah, what do you do? But just because not everyone was here last time, my name is Mordechai Torchiner, and I am, as was just said, Rosh Beit Midrash of the Yeshiva University, Torah Mitzvah Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. I get extra credit for the last two words. This is a rabbinical training program. It's a program in which we take rabbinical students from Yeshiva University or from Israel, and my job is to train them for the rabbinate, because I was in the rabbinate for 12 years before coming to Toronto. And so as part of my job, I teach the rabbinical students. We're also based in a boys' high school, Yeshivat Rechayim, in the Clanton Park area. So collectively, all of the members of this program work with the high school students as well, provide classes, formal, informal. And we also have university students who come study with us. And then when I'm not involved with the high school students, the university students, the rabbinical students, I am involved in wreaking havoc around town, giving classes, spreading what are the ideals of Yeshiva University and our Israeli parent organization, Torah Mitzvah. So all of which brings me here this evening to discuss love and justice. And this really does stand alone, separate from the class from last week. So I think that anyone who wasn't here last week, that's no problem. The truth is, as you look at the source sheets, there's an awful lot here, and there's an awful lot that I would love to take in a whole bunch of different directions and have discussion with and so on. And we'll be able to do some of that within the time frame that we have. But there isn't going to be enough time for everything that we want to do, and I would encourage you and really ask of you. My email address is at the top of the source sheet. If there's something that you want to discuss that we don't get around to, email me, please. I would love to continue the conversation. The goal tonight, from my perspective, is to get insight into the roles of love and justice in a Jewish marriage. And I thought I would do something which I do with my classes for doctors. I do a lot of medical ethics classes. And the doctors like vignettes. They like for you to present a case and then talk about what would you do in this case. So, Sally is 30 years old. She presents in the ER with such and such. What do you do type of a thing. So I have three vignettes. If anyone doesn't have a source sheet, I have a couple over here, and Ellie has some over by the door. So we're good? Okay. So here's the first one. Kate and Kevin, you like the alliteration. Kate and Kevin have been married for 10 years and have a 7-year-old daughter. Kevin has always handled the family's finances, and Kate is, frankly, very happy that way. But when a check bounces, Kate looks at their online banking records and sees that Kevin has been secretly funding a day trading account for years, using money they had intended for their daughter's university education. Can they repair their relationship? That's question number one. Now, I don't really want an up or down, like yes or no vote, although that might be interesting in its own right. But what do you think they would have to look at? What would be the considerations they would have to address in trying to repair their relationship? What should they be thinking about?
Communication.
Communication, meaning? Can you expand?
She didn't know that. Why didn't she know that?
Okay, so simply the fact that he didn't tell her what he was doing?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Trust.
Right. He didn't trust her. That's a really interesting way to look at it. When you said trust, I was thinking about it from the opposite direction. Like she has to be able to come to trust him because he did this behind her back. But you're right. The fact that he did it in secret demonstrated that he had a lack of trust for her. That's interesting. How do you build that? How do you work with that?
We don't know his reasons as to why he didn't tell her. Maybe he did trust her, but why didn't.
Could be.
He indicated that she was happy that he took care of the finances, so maybe it just never occur to her to even think about it. She thought, well, everything's cool, let him deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he probably just dealt with it and then screwed it or messed it up. I'm sure that was never his intention.
Yeah.
He lost money, but frankly the question would stand whether he lost money or not, right? Whether he's good at his deception or bad at it.
I'm still not sure what the question is. He said his division of labor used his money.
Right. The idea would be that he's been using money that they had intended for the daughter's university education to trade stocks.
Right. So that probably they were both aware of, hey, this money over here, we bought it for the daughter's.
Right. Right. Ellie, and then...
Okay.
One of the things that I would think they would have to go through is look at, like, is it a pattern? Mm-hmm. Something that's happened more than once.
Right. How does this fit into the general relationship that they have? An excellent, excellent question. Yes? Yeah?
Well, I think that they would have to deal with, is he prepared at this point to stop that behavior?
Mm-hmm. Is he prepared to stop that behavior? Which goes along with the...
trading his own money.
Well, he's trading money he has access to.
Exactly.
It's money he has access to. That's not the same thing as
being. There's a lot of assumptions in that. Like, yeah. Because I'm a couples therapist, I'm going to make no assumptions at all.
Okay.
So we're not talking about traditional halakhic marriage here.
Okay.
Right?
Because I mean, we could be, but we don't have to be.
Okay. Yeah, we could be. I agree. But I'm just saying, like, there's no context at all. I'm just waiting for... So there's an assumption here that they're supposed to consult on each financial decision. That's the deal within this marriage.
I don't think so, but I think that once they've decided that they're going to put money aside for the daughter's university education, that shouldn't be violated without them consulting each other again and saying, well, maybe we want to do something else with it, as opposed to just storing it away. Yes.
I was curious whether the day trading money was supposed to go back into the educational fund.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is his way of growing it quickly. Mm. I don't know the context of that, but that's about the rest of him to her. I find very interesting in terms of.
I don't know. I didn't present what his motivation was for doing this. Was his motivation, I feel like she's not going to be able to go to the university she wants, so let me grow this faster, and my wife won't understand these things, and she's nervous, so let me just not tell her, and don't worry about it, it'll be fine. Was this an addiction? He has a gambling issue, and this was a manifestation of it. We could present whatever extreme we want, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to move to the second case, because the second case makes the first one small potatoes, in my estimation. Sally and Steve have been married for 3 years and have a 1-year-old son. Steve is worried as Sally seems exceptionally stressed by taking care of their son. One evening, Sally breaks down and admits that she has been keeping a secret store of hard alcohol and drinking late at night, including during her pregnancy. Steve wants to take care of Sally, but he is disturbed by this long-standing deception and the extent of Sally's drinking. She is willing to go to rehabilitation and pursue ongoing help. What should he do? So now you have an added element, right, of endangering the child when she was pregnant, demonstrating the, it was in the past, but demonstrating how far this went. Yes? Absolutely. She's willing to take the expected steps. So it appears. Yes?
I think I agree with what Andrew said, just to kind of expound on that. You know, she's admitted that she has an addiction. We're obviously operating under the sense that this is some sort of mental disability as addiction. It's very commonly construed. It's, no one in the right mind will tell you that alcoholism is not some form of mental disability. So, for there to be some sort of tension of the fight.
yes, except if I want to, you know, argue the other side, I wouldn't argue about the alcohol. I would argue about the deception.
Alcoholism is a disease of deception.
Right. Correct. 100%. You can argue both sides of it. I'm just pointing out from his perspective, it's his feelings about being deceived. He's not angry at her because she's dealing with an alcohol addiction. He's angry because she hid this from him, endangered the child, and so on. I'm not trying to resolve these three vignettes that we're going to see in our opening 15 minutes that we can then sit back for the next hour and say, okay, we've solved the world's problems. I'm going to take Jerry's comment, and then I'm going to go to the third case. I'm sorry, Mark, it sounds like you have more to say with it. But I wouldn't say that. So the question that I'm asking is, how should the husband in this case, Steve, I think I gave the name, how should Steve deal with this situation? Should he look at this as a marriage he wants to continue with? Should he say, I actually want out of this kind of a relationship?
Is this Jerry? A general rule, though? Is this a general rule to say that he could just, on the basis of that information, decide whether or not to stay married to this woman? I mean, it's going to be a very individual decision, I think.
Yeah. No, I would tend to agree with that, as often happens with people who feel like they're now isolated, right? But, Jerry, are you going to say?
Well, I'm thinking back to a couple of things that you mentioned in last week's talk, and there's, about privacy of feelings, having an emotional connection with your spouse that you don't have with any other person, and... first case you mentioned, the second case, it's time for both couples to re-examine whether their goals, they still have the same common goals, and also to feel comfortable exposing their flaws, their weaknesses, and feel supported by it.
Right.
Working through those things with their spouse.
Right.
If the question is about should we continue this relationship or leave it because of this, well, the bond that they're trying to work towards and grow is, I'm losing it a little bit, but their relationship is set up to work through it.
Right. Possibly. I'm going to go to the third one. I'm going to add to this now with the third case, and then we're going to move into what I think is a source that brings out a lot of actually what Jerry was just saying. Wilma and Warren have been married for 30 years. The sources aren't on the sheet. I just gave a one line of summation for the vignettes. But Wilma and Warren have been married for 30 years. Their two children are grown and have moved out. Warren spends long hours at work, and when he comes home, he's still stressed about work. The stress leads him to be verbally abusive. He always apologizes, but the behavior continues. Wilma knows that Warren loves her, but the years of abuse have dragged her down, causing depression. Should she leave?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad that we are on the fence.
30 years, get some medication or something. Anyways, that's a very flippant answer to it, but it's, I don't know, after 30 years and your kids have left and all you can do is obsess about work, you've got a problem.
And the answer to having a problem is that his wife should then say, okay, see ya, it's been 30 years. And
well, maybe not, but get some help.
How aware is Warren of the impact of his actions?
Warren is aware, let's say.
He apologizes. You say
he knows it's wrong.
Is he aware? He knows it's wrong, but is he aware of the long-term effect it's having on life? Is he aware that she's sliding into depression?
We can create this as we like, because, I wrote this. Let's say...
simple answer is if the kids are gone, he doesn't need to work as hard, and that solves a lot of problems.
Is that true? The kids are gone, he doesn't have to work as hard?
He may choose to, but your biggest expense, well, your kids are gone, your biggest expense is to take care of.
Kids are gone does not mean kids are independent. Those are two different things. But I'll tell you what, I see hands on this, and I would love, again, like I said in the beginning, there's so much to discuss with this, but I'm actually going to move into what I believe is a source that addresses a lot of this in one piece. And that is source number two. It's a piece out of a paper by a woman by the name of Pauline Kleingeld. The paper is called Just Love, Marriage and the Question of Justice. And her thesis, as you can see in source number two, is that cultural injustice towards women is supported, she says, by the view that marriage is about love, not justice. And that importing justice into a marriage situation and saying, I have rights and I can expect certain things from my spouse, weakens the romantic side of the marriage. Now, leave aside, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with this article. My point is not to take a side on it, as much as to point out that she's raising a really interesting question. Take a look, please. It's source number two. She writes, beginning in the early modern period, a view came to dominate, according to which the family was considered a private realm, entirely distinct from the outside political, economic, and public spheres. This family was said to operate purely on the basis of love, and to form a harmonious, complementary unity of interests. As a result, according to the dominant view of the time, it was enough for one person to represent this unity in the public sphere. Bringing in considerations of justice means changing the mode of interaction within a good marriage. In order to promote justice in marriage, the social perception of the essence of marriage must be changed in such a way that the ideal of marriage is conceived of as not only a matter of love, but also of justice. In other words, what she's claiming is that historically, at a certain point in time, marriage came to be focused on love and emotional bonds, as opposed to the older model where it was a contractual agreement between parties. And she's claiming that once you say we operate purely, and I feel like I should have underlined her word purely, once you say we operate purely on the basis of love, it's uncomfortable to bring in justice. It's uncomfortable to say I deserve X from you because it violates the love element. Sorry? On the view I am proposing, she says, married couples ideally would think of themselves as sharing at least two overarching aims, a loving marriage and a just marriage. If the cultural understanding of marriage changed in this way, this would mean, first, that couples would understand themselves not only as communities of love, but also as communities of free and interdependent equals who treat each other in accordance with principles of justice. They would pursue fairness and reciprocity in the recognition of each other's interests, and they would pursue a just distribution of benefits and burdens, as well as a just resolution of conflicts. Her view is that you could equalize the positions of men and women within society if you start from a marriage and work your way from there. It's a very interesting thesis. I think that there's a lot that we could say about it, but I brought it here because of the point that she makes that bringing up justice can harm a marriage, right? Imagine the following scenario. You have a newlywed couple. I don't know. Maybe somewhere in this room. You have a newly married couple. And one day they're in the kitchen, and they're talking about something. And let's say the husband's way of talking is he talks with his hands. And so he's going like this and waving his hands around and carelessly knocks a mug off of the counter and it smashes on the floor and it happens to be her favorite mug. And he was careless and he smashed the mug. Now, she can't say, I want you to pay me for it, assuming we're dealing with a marriage in which you have pooled assets. That doesn't really work. But... you know, is she able to do something to say, my rights, so to speak, my rights have been violated in that you carelessly smashed something that was special to me? Or if she does that in any way diminish the love of the relationship by acting as though you owe me something? You know, saying you owe me something because you broke my mug. You follow what I'm asking?
What does this have to do with Torah?
Well, hang in there.
I totally hear what you're saying.
It's coming. Sorry?
I definitely hear what you're saying.
You should serve alcohol at this thing, right?
Yes. I have someone who says, I totally see it. We have someone who says, no, I need more. And now we have the same. Yeah.
So, does the thesis imply that justice and love are mutually exclusive?
The thesis not only implies it, it explies it. Right? It says it explicitly.
Yeah.
She has posited a love marriage, a loving marriage, and a just marriage as two unique things which could coexist, but they're two
not
different.
Not necessarily mutually exclusive. Because for me, I would say, if I love my wife, she doesn't have to ask me to. I'm going to go out and replace the mug anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
As to the best of my ability.
Right. And that's a good point. But what if you didn't do that? You didn't go out and do that. Now what's your wife's recourse? Sorry?
Well, I'm sleeping on the couch.
But that's exactly the point. Making you sleep on the couch because you broke the mug and didn't do anything about it is a claim towards a just marriage. And the question is, does making you sleep on the couch violate the idea of a loving marriage, or can the two, in fact, coexist?
How's she going
to
make him sleep on the couch?
Let the mechanics work themselves out. Andrea?
Like, I guess it also depends on, like, what it is. Like, the first reaction, like, when she sees her, like, favorite mug being broken might be to think, like, I'm so mad. But when she really thinks about it, it was an accident. Like, he didn't mean to do it. Like,
yeah. She
shouldn't expect anything. And, like, it's just a mug. Like, who cares at the end of the day? Like, I'm sure she has, like, 10 other mugs. Like, if it was something, you know, more meaningful, like, you know, her mother's china or, like, something. Maybe, no, like, something that had, like, that couldn't be, like, replaced, like, that had deep-seated meaning, like, mm-hmm. you know, but, like, just, like, you know, a mug. Like, again, I guess that it meant a lot to her, but at the end of the day, like, again, all these things are, like, material possessions. Like,
right.
And it was an accident. Like, you need to do it.
It's not only material, but I don't want to...
Like, you can't blame her for something that was... an accident, and, like, I'm sure he was sorry.
Right. I don't want to get caught up on the mug too much. Wait, you know what? I've got four hands here. And limited time. So what I'm going to actually do, I'm sorry, is take the one comment that I saw from the hand I saw first, and then I'm going to have to go a little further with this.
Just with my brother-in-law, did something very similar, and I'd love to share the way my sister responded when we get time.
Okay, maybe at the end we'll be able to do that, because I'd love to hear about your brother. No, I probably wouldn't. All right, yes, the one question or statement.
I was just going to say, I don't think that you can make an assessment based on the one incident, because, again, there's, you know, how did the husband respond to it? Did he just, you know, slough it off and say, oh, whatever? Or was he truly sorry about that? And... what is the pattern of behavior?
Right. So, an excellent, excellent point. What I want to do now is jump into some of the Torah sources that relate to this, and then hopefully at the end bring it back to some of the things we've been talking about, some of the comments that have been made. And again, I would rather hear you and do that, because I already know what's on the sheet. But I'm sort of, you know, like, here also to present this, so I'm going to do that. Last week... we took a look back at the original human marriage, that of Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, in the Garden of Eden, to introduce to us a key element of their relationship. We talked about exclusivity, the idea that the man is told, you're supposed to leave your parents behind, right? Yazav Isha Taviv et Imo, he leaves behind his father and mother, v'davak be'ishto, and he instead clings to his wife. And that was the exclusivity and emotional exclusivity conversation. But now I want to look at another piece of that relationship. Take a look at source number 3, please. Verse from Genesis. And God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I capitalize it because in Hebrew it's ha-adam, not Adam, the individual Adam, but ha-adam, the human race. It's not good for a human being to be alone. I will make for him a help opposite him. In the Hebrew, eselo ezer, la'azor, to help, kenegdo, opposite him. That's a really interesting turn of phrase. I will make for him a help opposite him, but the whole sentence is an interesting sentence. Because God says, lo tov heyot ha'adam levado, lo tov, it is not good For those who have read the creation account in the first chapter of Bereshit of Genesis, the phrase in Hebrew, lo tov, or in English, it is not good, does that ring a bell? Yes, where does it ring a bell from?
Ketov,
exactly. Every single day of creation, well, with one notable exception, but that's okay for this. In general, throughout creation, when God creates something, He looks at it and He says, Ki Tov. Vayara Elokim Ki Tov. God saw that it was good. And when He gets to the human being who is alone, He says, Lo Tov. This is not good. The classic way of studying biblical text was with a commentary in Aramaic, and there were several different Aramaic commentaries, not just one, although one has survived to this day, and a few have survived to this day, but one primary one has survived to this day. It's known as Targum Onkelos. Onkelos is Aramaic commentary to the Torah. It is not only a translation, it is definitely commentary as well. And in this case, he comments on Lo Tov. He says, La Takin. Takin is Taf Kuf Yud Nun for the Hebrew speakers. What it means is not functional. It is not functional for the man to be alone. This isn't going to get my creation where I want it to go, God says. Everything else, Kito, 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 these are all good. One case even Tov Me'od, very good, with a smiley from the teacher on the sheet.
Which would imply that all the other species had male and female counterparts to them already.
Yes. And which is in fact stated in creation. It says, Zacharu Nekeva Bara'am, He created them male and female. So yes, it's only the human being. We talked about last time briefly the two accounts of creation in Bereshit, of creation of human beings, and how it seems, based on Nachmanides' reading of it, that they're actually created as one soul made up of both of them inside one body, and God decides to separate them out at this juncture and say, you need to be two different people who meet each other and join together. But he says, Lo tov, it is not functional, it is not what I wanted in my creation. Heyot ha'adam levado, for the human being to be as one body. And therefore, I'm going to make him Ezer Kenegdo, a help opposite him. Take a look at source number 4, please, and see what the sages in the Talmud understood from that interesting turn of phrase, a help opposite him. The Talmud writes, Zacha Ozrehu, if he merits, she will help him. Lo Zacha, if he does not merit, she will oppose him. If he's good, and it's not just about him, the same works in the reverse. But if he's good, she'll help. And if he's not good, then he will have an opponent. And I think this teaches an important point regarding a Jewish view of marriage. It introduces the idea of earning the help of a spouse, of deserving the help of a spouse. There has to be, what we're seeing here, there has to be an element of justice in a relationship. If he doesn't deserve it, he's not getting the help. If she doesn't earn it, she's not getting his support. Yes?
So first we have to define tov, right? Because good cannot be subjective.
Right.
Especially in a relationship, there has to be a common vision of what good is.
Right.
Without that, you just have a question of taste, right?
Right, which is precisely why I brought in the Onkelos comment. He's saying it's not functional in the sense that this isn't what God had in mind in designing the world. This isn't going to get there. So whatever the divine goal is, and we could, you know, spend a few hours, you know, not figuring that out, but the goal that God has here is not served when man is alone. There have to be two beings in the relationship, and they have to earn the assistance of the other in order to serve whatever that end is. That's what I'm seeing here. The text doesn't say how you earn it, right? It doesn't say you have to be personally righteous. It doesn't say you have to bring the other flowers, right? It doesn't say. All it says is, if you merit it, if you earn it, then you will have the help. But otherwise not. But the idea clearly is, at least clearly to me, and I hope, you know, to the room, that it's not going to be a relationship if there isn't, or it won't be a working relationship, if there isn't justice within it. You will not have one helping the other if they don't do what they're supposed to do for the other. Yes?
The term low total only refers to Adam. So would that imply that the earning is only one way?
Why do you say it only refers to Adam?
Because in the text, it's only low total Adam. It's not good that man should be alone.
Right, so that's why I stress...
It never says woman can't be alone.
Right. That's why I stress that in the Hebrew, it's lo tov heyot ha-adam. He isn't talking about Adam, but rather the human race. It's not good for human beings to be alone.
But at the time that was said, women didn't exist yet. So we don't have...
Neither did man, in essence, either, then. You can argue that, too.
But at the time that statement was made, you know, women didn't exist yet. So it's possible that women, once women were created, they could function on their own. Only the men that were... That the comment was made about could not.
So well, the thing is that the word ha-adam is referring to human beings as they are right then. There's no reason to distinguish.
Human beings' nature changed shortly after.
Hang on. What I'm getting at is that as the Talmud presents it, and that's what I was sort of shorthanding with the quote from Nachmanides, is actually that there is a male body and there is a female body, and they are back to back. In other words, Adam is as much male as he is female. Or he is as much female as he is male. You can no more say that lo tov ha-adam is referring to the man than you can that it was referring to the woman. It's gender neutral, effectively. Adam, the Adam, is a reference to the species. That's the way that I would read that.
So once that split is made,
yeah,
the very nature of ha-adam changes mm-hmm. to be either male or female.
Well, not ha-adam. Adam does. Ha-adam is still the human race.
Right, but the nature of what it means to be human changed from gender neutral to a split between genders.
Yeah.
Once that split's made, then the nature of this idea of ha-adam, this idea of the human race, changes.
Yeah.
So that lo-tov may no longer apply.
I don't see why it would.
Lo-tov is referring to a status.
I'll tell you what. If you want, we can debate it further. But I'm gonna go ahead with this because
I hear what you're saying.
You hear what he's saying. Okay, so you, wait a second, we'll do this all together. But
let's further his premise.
He said probably the bud like the food.
So let's go a little further with it. Because there's so much more to say. We haven't even gotten to the prophets. We talked about relationships from the prophets, and right now we've got relationships working on the from. Generally speaking, our prophets have prioritized love over justice. Now, first I'm going to contradict that before explaining it. We have many prophets who are what are called in Hebrew Nevi'ei Emet, prophets of truth, committed to a vision of justice. Going way back, Sarah evicts Yishmael, right, her teenage stepson, because he is wrong for her biological son, Yitzchak, Isaac. So she evicts him from the house. He's a threat to Isaac. Now, he is already 17, and in that world, 17, you know, like it was until the last couple of centuries, or even the last century, 17 wasn't bad. But still, he's kicked out of the house. She says, this is the way it ought to be. And Abraham, her husband, who is the epitome of chesed and kindness, has a very hard time with it until God says, she told you to do it, do it. That's the rule. But but she kicks him out. Jeremiah, the classic prophet Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, who predicts the destruction of the first temple. Take a look at source number 5. He asks God, why is the path of the wicked successful? Why are the betrayers at peace? You have planted them, you God. They have also developed roots. They go forth. They also bear fruit. You are near in their mouths, but far from their innards. They talk about you, God, but they don't actually have that commitment inside. And he is offended. And no one gets offended like Jeremiah gets offended. He is offended by the existence and the thriving of wicked people. We're going to see it with Elijah the prophet shortly. Nonetheless, we are taught that God prioritizes kindness. Take a look, please, at source number 6. This is a classic midrash. We could spend hours just talking about this one source. We won't. But we could. Listen to this. Rabbi Simon said, Simon in the original. So he's Israeli, and it was Simon in the Babylonian, it would be Shimon. When God came to create Adam, the ministering malachim is the word we use for angels. I don't like translating it as angels, because angels is a very different image than malach. So I rendered it as malachim, but that's the idea. These forces that God is using to create the world, they formed groups. Some saying he should not be created. Don't create human beings. And some saying he should be created. Generosity, chesed, said he should be created, for he performs kindnesses. He's a good guy. He's going to help people. Well, once there was more than one person anyway. And truth, Emmet, said he should not be created because he is entirely of lies. Justice said he should be created, for he performs acts of justice. Shalom, peace, said he should not be created because he is entirely of quarrels. What did God do? It's 2-2. What do you do? Shoot out over time. He took truth and he cast it to the ground. And he quotes a verse about Tashlech Emet Arza, you cast truth to earth. Like I said, we could discuss this one forever. What is it? What in the world are you talking about? There's a debate going on, and God has to listen to one of them. He threw truth down to the earth. Why did he pick truth to throw down to the earth as opposed to any of the others? Yeah, I'd love to sit here and discuss this midrash, but my point in bringing it here is simply to say that the sages are telling us that the bias is on the side of kindness. There is a bias towards love. There's a bias towards generosity. That's what is of principal interest to God. And that comes through in the prophets, and I'm going to show you three prophets who argue for kindness in different ways, based on three reasons to go for kindness. Now, I'm a little bit restricted in the way I'm going to do this, in the sense that only one out of the three prophets that I'm going to bring is definitely talking about marriage. The other two are talking about it in relationships in general. So I have to acknowledge that from the outset. But the first one that I want to bring talks about the importance of a relationship, of love in a relationship over justice, because we have a responsibility to take care of our spouse. We have a responsibility to take care of the other person in our relationship, to be their defender to the world, and to be their ally. And that comes forth in the following passage regarding Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet. A little bit of background for source number 7, which we're about to read. Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, speaks to the Jews during the first temple period. This is a time when the Jews have split into two kingdoms, a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. The northern kingdom has descended into idolatry. Things are very difficult there. There are coups, the assassinations. It's not a pretty picture. The southern kingdom, which includes Jerusalem, where the temple is a little bit more stable. But Elijah is in the wild north. That's where he brings his message to the people. And there's a king by the name of Ahab, who married a woman by the name of Jezebel. What's Jezebel? Jezebel in English is?
Jezebel.
One and the same. They are into all sorts of horrible things by the standards of Tanakh. And there's a passage in which Elijah has a showdown with the prophets of Baal, which is a Canaanite idolatry, and he wins the showdown. They both build altars, so long story, but in the end, he wins the showdown, a fire comes down from heaven, it consumes his offering, and demonstrates that God is the true God, and the Baal is not. And then in the next chapter, Jezebel, Jezebel wants to kill him. And so he runs away. He spends 40 days in the wilderness, finally arriving at a cave at Mount Horeb. Mount Horeb is also known as Mount Sinai. And take a look at what happens in source number 7. And he, Elijah, came there, to the cave, and he rested there. And the word of God came to him, saying to him, "Why are you here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been zealous for God, master of multitudes, for the children of Israel have left your covenant, they have ruined your altars, they have killed your prophets, and only I remain, and they seek to take my life." So he says to God, he criticizes the Jews. Have you ever heard of the practice of having a chair at a Brit Milah? right, for Elijah the prophet. So that traces back to this source where he accuses the Jews of leaving God's covenant, and God says to him, now, every time they fulfill the covenant, you have to testify to it. So you have to go to the Brit. You have to go to witness this. But that's his claim. He says, the Jews have sinned, they've killed your prophets, they're terrible. And he said, so God says to him, depart. He says, leave the cave and stand upon the mountain before God. God passed before him, and a great and mighty wind before God, breaking mountains and smashing stones. And God was not in the wind. And after the wind came an earthquake, and God was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire, and God was not in the fire. And after the fire, called Mamadaka, a voice, silent and small. God's response to him. What is the meaning of God's response to Elijah? When Elijah rages and says, they violated your covenant, they've killed your prophets, only I remain. And God responds with this scene and says, I am in this small voice. What is God saying to him? Ellie. Mm-hmm. Good, that's one approach. There are many approaches that you can bring. I'm going to show you one in source number 8. I wasn't being disingenuous by asking people. It was just that I hadn't looked at the clock yet. But take a look at source number 8. Rabbi David Altshuler, writing in the 19th century in his commentary to this text, says, he, God, showed Elijah the glory and did not pass in wind, earthquake, and fire, but in a voice, silent, small. For he desires generosity. He does not arouse all of his anger, coming with wind, earthquake, and fire. In other words, what Rabbi David Altshuler in the Mitzvot David commentary is saying is that, Elijah, I don't want the fire and brimstone. I don't want you raging at the people and accusing them of wrongdoing. Speak gently. Speak softly. That's the message here. You are responsible not to accuse, but to defend. And that, I think, is the first point. That the spouse is there to defend the other spouse, not to accuse. That's number one. Number two, and this one is from the story of Jonah. And I translated an entire chapter of the book in source number 9. I am so taken with this text. This is one of my favorites in all of Tanakh, which may or may not be something you can say, but I said it. This is a remarkable chapter. If you're familiar with the story of Jonah, God sends Jonah to the city of Nineveh. Nineveh is the capital of the Assyrian Empire. Often when this is read, it's read on Yom Kippur in the afternoon traditionally, so people are a little out of it and they certainly don't know the context. The Assyrian Empire is hostile to the Jews who are living in their land. At that time there's still a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and Jonah is actually a prophet there in the northern kingdom. But the Assyrians are a hostile nation. And they have this port city, a mighty city of Nineveh. And God tells Jonah, I want you to go to the city of Nineveh and warn them in 40 days the city's going to be overturned. And Jonah says, I don't want anything to do with it. I'd rather go be eaten by a fish. He says, no, I'm going out to sea. Fish sticks. I'm going out to sea. Instead, I want to flee from God. Not in the sense that he thinks you can run away from God, but in the sense that he thinks he can run away from being the messenger. Let God speak to somebody else. I'm leaving his holy land. I'm going away. And he gets thrown into the sea, and he actually wants to be thrown into the sea, and that's its own story. But, you know, I'm encapsulating a book here and doing it injustice. But in the end, he says to God, okay, I'm going to do what you want. Fine, I'll do what you told me to do. And so he goes to the city of Nineveh, and he walks into the city, and he gives his big announcement, and the people say, oh no, we've been terrible, and the king leads them in apparent repentance. They wear sackcloth, they fast, they give back things they stole, and everything is going to be wonderful. And watch what happens then in chapter 4 of Jonah. This is chapter 4. And Jonah found this very bad, and he was angered. And he prayed to God, and this will be the strangest prayer you ever hear. with the possible exception of one chapter in Job. But he says, and he prayed to God, saying, "Please, God, this is what I have said ever since I was on land, back when the book started. Therefore, I fled to Tarsus preemptively. For I know that you are gracious and merciful, patient and very generous, regretting harm. Now, God, please take my life from me. My death would be better than my life." He says, "God, I know you're merciful. And frankly, I'm not interested. I don't want a world in which you're merciful. They're terrible people. They should be punished. And I knew what you were going to do. I knew you were going to change your mind. I knew you were going to accept their repentance. I can't live with this." And God says to him, and you can hear the laughter in his voice. He says, "Hayitev charalach. Is it good that you're angry?" Or possibly you could translate, "You good and angry now?" And Jonah left the city and lived east of the city. And he made a hut for himself and he sat in its shade to see what would be in the city. And God appointed a kikayon plant, some kind of fast-growing plant, and it grew above Jonah as shade over his head to save him from harm. So now he's sitting there, he's got his shade, he's happy. And Jonah was very happy about the kikayon. And God appointed a worm at dawn of the next day, and it struck the kikayon, which dried out, right? Ate away at the roots. The idea of God appointing something is a theme throughout the book in the text, but that's also beyond what we're going to talk about now. And when the sun shone, God appointed a deafening east wind, and the sun beat down on Jonah's head, and he collapsed. He asked to die, saying, "My death would be better than my life." We've heard that one before, right? And God said to Jonah, "Is it good that you're angry about the kikayon?" Right? Clearly echoing his earlier statement. And Jonah said, "It is good. I'm angry to death." And God said, "You had mercy on the kikayon, for which you did not work, which you did not raise, which appeared in a night and was lost in a night. Should I not have mercy upon Nineveh, the great city, which holds more than 12,000 people who do not know right from left, as well as many beasts?" What he's telling Jonah, long story short, is get perspective. Right? Get perspective. You were just as angry about the concept of divine justice as you were about the loss of a kikayon plant. And you take just as seriously your own happiness and satisfaction as the survival of 12,000 people, plus animals in the city. Jonah, you can't be outraged at everything. You can't get angry at everything. If you're getting angry at everything, something is wrong. And that's his message here. And the Talmud says God never speaks to him again. This is it for their interaction. The message here to Jonah that I see, and again, you could read this and see so many other messages, and I'm doing this so quickly, but I want to get across this key idea. Often what upsets us is small potatoes. And we get caught up, like you said, it's just a mug. You know, we get caught up beyond what is proportional. And so that's a second reason to prioritize love over justice. It's very dangerous to play the justice game because you have to know what you're doing. And then third, and this one is marriage related, is the rather interesting story of a prophet by the name of Hosea, or Hosea as it's often rendered in the English. Hosea is not one of those they teach kids about in day school. I kind of hope, actually. Because the story of Hosea, for those who are not familiar, is that he has a bit of a fight with God. He turns to God and he says, "You know, God, why is it that you're patient with these Jews? You should punish the Jews. They've sinned against you." And he's also a prophet towards the end of the first temple period, this period when the Jews are straying and they're corrupt and so on. And God says to him, "Here's your job. Take a look at source number 10. God said to Hosea, go take for yourself a straying woman and children from straying, for the land strays from after God." Now, using the word stray and words like that helps conceal what's really going on. What he says to him is he should go marry a woman who was known for promiscuity. And he should then raise a family with her, not knowing whether the children are his own or not his own. That's God's message to the prophet Hosea. Take a look at source number 11, where the Talmud gives us then background on what happens in the rest of... It gives us kind of the backstory to where things go in this incident with Hosea. He has a few children, and God names the children for him, tells him what to name them, and they're named for the distance between God and the Jewish people. And then after that, God says to him, well, take a look. After two sons and a daughter were born to him, God said to Hosea, should you not have learned from Moses, your master? When I spoke to him, he separated from his wife, which is its own story. You should also separate from her. God says to him, you're a prophet. Why are you hanging out with this woman? You should be dedicated just to me. So God says to him. Hosea said, master of the universe, I have children from her. I can't send her away and divorce her. She's the mother of my children. At which point, God turns to him and says, now you understand my relationship with the Jewish people. Now you get why I love them despite everything that happens, and I'm not going to pursue justice. These are my children that are involved. And so the message here is, look what you've built together. Look what you've invested in. These three sources convey three messages in favor of prioritizing love over justice. Number one, you're their ally. You're your spouse's ally. Number two, you can't get upset about small things. And number three, look what you've built together. Look what you've invested in. Now, there's a lot to say about that, but now I have to go back in the other direction. Because this is not absolute. The Jewish version of marriage that we saw before holds expectations of justice, of earning the trust of the other person, the cooperation of the other person. And so from these three prophets themselves, we will now see the opposite message. Not the opposite, I think of it as the complementary message. Number one, let's go back to the story of Elijah again. We read the story of Elijah and how he runs away to this mountain and he complains about the Jews, and God shows him that he is in the still, small voice. But take a look at source number 12, which is the rest of that story. And when Elijah heard this, he hid his face in his cloak. When he heard this message from God, he hid his face in his cloak and he departed. And he stood at the entrance to the cave. And a voice came to him saying, why are you here, Elijah? Which you may recall was what started this. Back in source number 7, God said to him, why are you here, Elijah? The same exact words are used in the Hebrew. Malachafo Eliyahu, why are you here, Elijah? And he said, I have been zealous for God, master of multitudes, for the children of Israel have left your covenant, they have ruined your altars, they have killed your prophets, and only I remain, and they seek to take my life. Sound familiar? It's exactly what he said before the sound and light show. He's saying the same exact thing. And God said to him, go, return to your path to the wilderness of Damascus, and you will come and anoint Hazael as king upon Aram, and you will anoint Jehu son of Nimshi as king upon Israel, and you will anoint Elisha son of Shaphat of Avil Meholah as prophet in your place. You catch the significance of the last words? What is he saying to Elijah? You're fired. That's what he's saying to Elijah. He's saying, you're fired. Go appoint this person to be the next prophet. You didn't pick up on the message. There does come a point where the person isn't learning. There has to be some kind of vision of growth. There has to be a vision of how this is going to lead to a healthy relationship, even if they haven't earned it now. If they're going to earn it soon, soon is a very hard word to work with, and it's very specific to the case involved. I don't think you can easily define it. But if there is an end game where you can see things progressing, then we can deal with that. But if I can give this big show to him to teach him this lesson, and he can come back with the same exact words that he had before, then it's time for somebody else. So sometimes the person just isn't learning. That's number one. Number two, going back to Hosea, this prophet who was told to go be with this straying woman that we saw before. Take a look at source number 13. God says to Hosea, quarrel with your mother, and by mother here he means nation. It's the word that's used can mean both. I brought both possibilities. Quarrel with her, for she is not my wife, God says, and I am not her husband. Let her remove her straying from before her. The message here that God gives to the Jews via this prophet is, while the straying is going on, I am not her husband, she is not my wife. In other words, there has to be a halt to the activities, like was mentioned before when we talked about the day trader, right? There has to be a point where you first stop doing whatever it is that's destructive, and then we can talk about what happens. But you have to have that halt first to the destructive tendency. And then finally, there's a last point, and then I'm going to summarize. One has to recognize that repentance is a lifelong process. It isn't something that happens once, and then everything is fine. We talked about alcoholism, and you know, it's well known, I think, that you know, the alcoholic doesn't ever say, I'm now out of it, it's no longer an issue for me anymore. A person is a recovering alcoholic for life. That's the way it works. And the same thing is true in many scenarios, that one is recovering forever. And I go back to the story of Jonah and the people of Nineveh, because you know what the secret of the book of Jonah is that no one ever tells you? The secret of the book of Nineveh is that Jonah was right. He may not be right in terms of how justice works, but he is dead on regarding the people of Nineveh. Because after the book of Jonah ends, the people go right back to doing what they were doing before. 40 days went by, the city wasn't destroyed. Okay, party time. We go back to everything that we were doing before, the powerful abusing the weak, the whole bit. We're going to go back to square one. And which is why there's another book, less well known than Jonah. It's a book of Tanakh. It's called Nahum, the prophet Nahum. And it begins, source number 14, the vision of Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum of Elkosh, and it begins, God is outraged. And indeed, Nineveh and the Assyrian Empire are destroyed by the Babylonians. And Nahum is this vision of that happening because they backslide. So it's really important to remember that this has to go on in an ongoing way. It has to be something that isn't just a once and done deal. So to sum up what we've said, and I realize I rushed through an awful lot, and from the bottom of my heart I apologize for that, and I hope that there's a finite period of time that we can stay here afterwards to talk about it, but I hope people will pursue by email as well, because I would like to continue the conversation. But what we've seen is, number one, the initial question: is it wrong to demand justice? Is it a violation of the love of a marriage to demand justice? And we began by seeing that Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, are created with a vision of a just relationship in which one earns the cooperation of the other. That's what makes it tov. That's what makes the relationship good, what makes it functional. Generally speaking, the prophets prioritize love over justice despite their love of truth. We had three messages. Number one, you are the ally of your spouse. Number two, don't get upset about the small things, right? Like Jonah with the kikayon. And number three, look at what you've built together and invested in, like the family that you have. But on the other hand, we have the three opposing points, which are, if the person isn't learning and growing, if they're not moving past it, then it's time to indeed say, enough is enough. Number two, you can't stay in the relationship while something harmful is going on, from Hosea. And number three, from Jonah, there has to be this process, which is a lifelong process, of growing and improving and not backsliding. Now, from a Jewish law perspective, there are certain cases where repentance is not possible in a relationship. It's technical and beyond the scope of what we're going to say right now. I just have to acknowledge it for the sake of being completely honest. But generally speaking, we do have the idea that as long as you're satisfying these principles, then the repentance is possible and the love is possible. And I want to close with one beautiful quote. Take a look at source number 15. For those who put on tefillin, this will be familiar because it is actually recited daily when wrapping the tefillin on one's fingers. It is from that same prophet Hosea, who is told by God to go marry the promiscuous woman. But here it is God addressing the Jews. And he says, Ve'erastich li le'olam, I will betroth you for me forever. I will betroth you for me in righteousness, justice, generosity, and mercy. And finally, Ve'erastichli be'emunah v'yadat et Hashem, and I will betroth you for me in loyal faith, and you will know God. And that middle line is primarily what I'm bringing it for. I will betroth you for me in righteousness, justice, generosity, and mercy. The two are not mutually exclusive, the love and the justice. You can have the righteousness and the justice, that insistence of zacha ezer, you have to earn the help of the other, and at the same time, the generosity and the mercy, the love and the relationship as well. I think both are fundamentally important for the health of a functional Jewish marriage. Thank you very much.